Sustain 267.
Welcome to the Sustain 267 podcast, where we look at environmental issues affecting climate change in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I'm your host, Batlukidi Sidzi. Happy Africa Day. So, 57 years ago, on the 25th of May, in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, 32 heads of independent states founded the Organization of African Union, known as the OAU, guided by the philosophy of Pan-Africanism, which centered on African socialism and promoted African unity. The communal characteristics and practices of African communities, and a drive to embrace Africa's culture and common heritage. Then in July 2002, now in Durban, South Africa, the African Union, also known as the AU, was officially launched. And the decision to relaunch Africa's Pan-African organization was the outcome of a consensus by African leaders that to realize Africa's potential, there was a need to refocus attention from the fight for decolonization and ridding the continent of apartheid to increased cooperation and integration of African states to try to drive Africa's growth and economic development. Today, the AU has 55 member states that make up what is the continent of Africa. For the past 57 years, the 25th of May has been observed throughout the continent as Africa Day, and it's intended to celebrate and acknowledge the successes of the AU, while reflecting upon the common challenges that the continent still faces in a global environment. The theme for this year is Silencing the Guns, Creating a Conducive Environment for Africa's Development. I'll be unpacking the theme with five African climate activists from across the continent and chatting to Aya Shebi on our closing feature, African Bites. I spoke to the founder of Gambian Marine and Environmental Conservation Initiative, environmental officer of Mbolo Association, and a passionate climate change and indigenous rights activist, Yande Salah Mohammed. First, I asked her to share her thoughts as an African climate change activist and an activist in The Gambia on the 2020 Africa Day theme.
I try to, as much as possible, just think of Africa Day as a day of like celebrating independence more than celebrating it as like the founding of the AU personally, because I don't think there are enough celebrations of African independence. So this is a really special day to me. For the theme of the Silencing the Guns, I mean, I was introduced to this theme when I was in Ethiopia for the Resilient 40 conference. And when I was first presented with the theme, I was a bit confused. I feel like it was very general because we were presented silencing the guns on food scarcity, silencing the guns on water inaccessibility, silencing the guns on climate change. There were just like so many themes that were wrapped into silencing the guns, but I didn't think that the title of silencing the guns was very conducive for me. I think that it would be more of an impact to me, in my opinion, of having something that was very clear, not something saying silencing the guns. Because, of course, when you have climate change, you always will have some type of violence. But I think we need to think of the issues of climate change in a whole different way, personally. The positive side are, you know, looking at Africa Day as a great day, celebrating the African independence, celebrating the African revolutionaries and freedom fighters that got us out of colonization, and constantly moving forward with the ideals of fighting against any type of neocolonialism, focusing on uplifting indigenous peoples, indigenous languages, indigenous rights, you know. This is kind of what I like to focus on for Africa Day. This will always be the theme for me. Even if there are other themes, I always will think of Africa Day as this.
And then you made mention of the forefathers who helped us gain our independence. What can we draw from them? What lessons can we draw from them as climate change activists as we move to address the challenge that is now upon us?
So I think from taking all of this energy from the founding, as far as my understanding, I obviously wasn't there. But when I look back on it, and I've read a lot of books about these beginning times, about many of the people involved, a really big person in my area of the world in Gambia obviously would be our surrounding countries, you know, very prolific writer would be Sheikh Anta Diop. So I was recently reading a lot about how they had this idea of this very united Black Africa and this liberation movement. And I think it's really important to really keep that energy throughout everything, of not focusing too much on having all of these foreign partners that are exploiting our resources, like focusing on as many people that we can partner with outside, you know, focusing more on partnering together and putting together all of these African states and joining together and being determined and creating our own future together and really, you know, building our powers as, you know, siblings, as countries, as partners, geographically, you know, as well. I think there's just a lot of focus on how we can get help from outside. And we need to figure out now that, well, we have been figuring out anyway, that we can all help each other and join together. And it's a really big thing that we need to focus on. I think that people nowadays will think that we are very connected. We are very Pan-African. But from my readings from before, I was seeing that there is like a lot of inter-travel between leaders, focusing on sharing ideas, sharing ways of liberation. And I feel like now, from how I'm seeing leaders now, they're not so much focusing on joining together with their neighboring countries and more focusing on joining together with any other Western power that can help aid them. And I really think we need to go back to when we were all trying to join together and liberate. Now that we are free and independent, for the most part, like, how can we figure out to move forward? How can we figure out to stop this exploitation? For example, here in the Gambia, we have a huge issue with the exploitation of our fishing business. We have a huge overfishing problem where we have Chinese fish meal factories here that are completely decimating our fishing population. People that catch fish have to actually sell the fish to the Chinese, who then sell it back to them. It's just like a huge problem. And we need to look at ways that we can stop this exploitation from foreign powers and really focus on how we can benefit ourselves within our continent.
Drawing from the African Union's agenda of 2063, the Africa we want. You have mentioned a bit on the kind of the Africa you want, mm-hmm. but holistically, what is the Africa you want as we continue with Agenda 2063?
This is a big question. The Africa I want would be, so the Africa I want is very complex and very unrealistic. But looking at the realities that we're faced with now, it's difficult, you know, especially when we have so many problems of, resources, be it water resources, land resources, etc. The Africa that I want would be one that would be like a very big thing for me, especially coming from the Gambia, where it seems like everybody is just constantly taking from us. And then we just get the scraps of whatever infrastructure was implemented for tourism. I would like to see an Africa that's focused more on inter-African benefit, because I feel like it's something that's really lacking. At least when I go to different parts of Africa, I see completely different systems. But I would like to see something where everything is sort of meshed together. Like, we all have some sort of, like, something is meshing. Like, we all, like, you can feel like you are there, and we're all there in the same place. I feel like everything feels so split apart. Even from a simple travel from like Gambia to Senegal, I feel like I'm in complete different worlds with complete different ideas. In Gambia, it's a problem of access to electricity. You know, there's so many other problems that when I go to Senegal, it's a whole different issue. But even within those different countries, they all have their own issues. I think we need to focus a lot on education, of course. University, but definitely in Africa, there's a lack of access to education, and education on sustainability, education on women's empowerment in general, through education and in general, access to good healthcare. Good healthcare systems are very important, and access just to information. I feel like everyone thinks that there is all this information out there, but it doesn't trickle down to people, especially in rural communities. I feel like there needs to be a huge spread of information going to everyone, regardless of their living standards, and that there needs to be an equal living standard for everyone. So, yeah, this is something I would definitely like to see. My ideal Africa is a bit, it's a bit of a fairy tale and dream when I really get into talking about it. But I think at the basics, it would be something very much like this. I think we think that we are free and liberated, but I think there is a very, very long way to go for true liberation and freedom. But hopefully we're on the right path.
I also had a chat with the founder of Eswatini Climate Coalition, artist and environmentalist Dane Armstrong, on what this year's theme means to him.
I guess it sort of starts from the fundamental point that we're really not going to get anywhere in our respective communities or countries or the world as a whole if we're constantly fighting with each other. And I think anyone working in climate or environmental issues will realize that in times of chaos, which in humanity's sort of bigger picture generally means times of war or conflict, we really, our priorities shift a lot, you know, to our own sense of security, safety, etc. But also the powers that be seem to be focused also on either attack or defense, and necessarily budgets get reapportioned accordingly. So it's hard to imagine how you're ever going to work towards the kinds of drastic action we need to see to address the climate crisis if we're constantly fighting with each other. And I think it is something that's been there since day one with the environmental movement over the decades. But I think has got increasing sort of traction over the years, where you realize like socioeconomic impacts are really what we care most about in our kind of hierarchy of needs. And if we don't sort those things out, we're not going to get to the sort of other levels that we need to be addressing with the environment. Of course, they're more important than our petty conflicts, but on a personal and individual level, you can't tell that to somebody who's just trying to keep themselves safe in under certain circumstances. So we need to be working towards, I mean, I guess conflict resolution in its very fundamental way. And of course, it's very black and white to just say that we need to be working towards peace. That's something we've been trying for a long time everywhere. But yeah, that it's really is the foundation for any kind of change that we want to see. And anyone who is a devout climate or environmental activist, it's very easy to kind of have that be your main badge that you wear, but you know, you run the risk of alienating people if you don't realize what their most immediate needs are. And that conflict comes in many different ways. You know, that's domestic violence, or that's civil war, or that's massive international conflicts. I mean, all of them are going to be impacting people severely, and that becomes their main kind of obstacle that they need to first overcome before they're going to think about anything else at all. So securing things from an individual community level, but also shifting the mindset of the powers that be. I don't know how you do that, but we're not really getting anywhere unless we do that.
You talked of we have to be respective of the other challenges that are going on while we try to pursue combating and addressing climate change. So respective of that, what do you think a conducive environment for pushing the climate change agenda and addressing it would look like for you as an activist?
I suppose the easiest is, or the thing that comes first to mind in a bigger scale level is, you know, when you look at the kinds of amounts of money that we need to address environmental destruction or put things in place or subsidies that promote companies or actions that are working towards our solutions. And then you look at the amount of money that countries are spending on armed conflicts or on their defense budgets or on their armies. I mean, and this holds true for every single sector that any environmental or social justice movement, you know, a lot of issues could be alleviated with just reimagining and reworking the way that we spend our money on a national level. And that has always been the case, but I think we have to keep on harping on with that. Here in Eswatini, we have a huge portion of the budget that gets spent on the defense fund, the army. And this is a country that has never been in a war, never had a civil conflict. And I think it's becoming increasingly untenable to keep on putting that much money into something that a lot of people see as unnecessary. We should be focusing on adaptation measures for a crisis that is already here and is only going to get worse. You know, unless you start turning those mechanisms at the top, it's really hard to imagine how those kinds of changes will trickle down the chain to your smaller, you know, your ministry level, your NGOs, your parastatals, your community groups, your chieftaincies, your households. I mean, once you see the priority shifting from above, then that sort of happens below as well. But it is also got to happen the other way around. And I think on a personal and community level, people are doing things already, because if you're a farmer, it's your livelihood that's at stake. If there's a drought, if there's things happening, you need to invest your own time and money into things. But of course, having that feeling that you're being left to your own devices is never helpful. You'd like to see things happening from above that are pushing that change as well. And it's very unfortunate that it's only coming from external forces. foreign NGOs or aid donors, whether it's huge ones like UNDP, etc., or the American Embassy, or whether it's more individualized entities generally from the global north, when we need to start seeing that shift happening from within as well. We all have countries that have budgets that know how to, within reason, run a country. So there's no reason why we should be relying on that kind of assistance completely from the outside. We also have to start shifting that own narrative within ourselves. And everyone is recycling, that's great, but like, let's also move beyond that into things that have stronger and more lasting impacts.
On the military budget, that just doesn't make sense. As a Motswana, I completely understand where you're coming from. We have a bit of the same problem here. But then picking up on what you said about wanting to see solutions that are long-lasting, drawing from the Africa Union's Agenda 2063, which is the Africa we want, what's the Africa you want?
It's a very interesting question. Really important in these times of global uncertainty. You know, how do we promote identities and be proud of who we are and where we're from, but also appreciate connections and unity without resorting to sort of closed-minded nationalism and only feel like we can all do this by ourselves. Thank you very much. We'll close our borders and we don't need anybody else. Well, while that's true to a certain degree, we should be pushing for more of that. And I can only speak from Eswatini, where we're so reliant on, you know, food and energy imports, when we could be a lot more self-sustaining and resilient than we currently are. And we should push for those kinds of things without having that narrative of we're completely fine, thank you, we'll close our borders, we don't want anyone or any help. It is about cooperating, but it is about being more resilient for yourself at the same time. You know, and the kind of, I think the analogy you can use is on an individual level. Like you need to be secure with yourself and happy with yourself, but we also need other people. We are social beings, and I think we need to see our communities and countries in the same light. And on a kind of Pan-African level, that needs to really start coming to the fore. You know, we need to learn from what works with things like the European Union, but also what doesn't work about things like the European Union, and how we can do it differently in a way that is more beneficial for people on the ground, and not just a bureaucratic system that enables better trade that works for people at the top. And I think a lot of the narrative happening around Africa, at least, is for the kind of trade and free market access that we are kind of emulating. And I really don't think it's a system that has been very beneficial to raising equality levels, for example, around the world. And we really need to rethink any kind of model that is based on any neoliberal capitalist systems that have been pushing us over the brink. And we need to move away from that. And we've got ample resources. We do want to be connected with the world. The world has got things we don't have. We've got things the world doesn't have. How can we work together? But how can we strengthen each other first? But also without running the risk of any kind of superiority complexes from the larger countries on the continents. On the continent, you know, your South Africa and your Nigeria, etc., where yes, you're leaders in every sense, but how can you bring everybody along with you so that there's less need for people to feel like they need to escape their own countries for the brighter lights? You know, if we're leaving anybody behind, then we're not getting anywhere. And you know, if we only develop half of the continent, then the other half is just either going to be in conflict or want to be in the other half, or both. And that's kind of what we're seeing increasingly around the world, which is why we have a lot of forced migration. And if we want to see less of that, people don't want to leave their homes. They want to be where they come from, where they are, where they've always been for generations. And I think we need to fundamentally focus on the kinds of structures that need to be in place that allow countries and communities to be healthy in their own right so that people can thrive where they want to. But yeah, that kind of starts with our main problems, which are really around corruption and conflict. And a lot of that is fostered from the outside. It's not an African problem. It's been stoked since pre-colonial days and continues to be. So we do need to be aware of what the issues are that we can solve ourselves, but also which buttons are being pressed from the outside, and start building something that's stronger. Because when the climate crisis starts hitting us in ways that are much worse than we've currently experienced, and we're not ready for it, we're going to see a lot more migration. We're going to see a lot more devastation in certain countries. They're not ready for it. And everyone takes turns needing help. And we like the ideal Africa that I see is that any nation could turn around and help somebody else because they're in a hard time, much the same as people. You know, we all take turns needing a loan or needing a shoulder to cry on. But then the next day, we're that person giving a loan or being that shoulder. And I think countries need to be the same.
I then crossed over to Kenya for a conversation with climate activist, entrepreneur, and global shaper Wanjuhi Njoroge on her take on the Africa Day 2020 theme.
This theme was launched in September of 2013, and we were to achieve it in 2020. However, as important as this theme is, I at times wonder why Africa Union constantly comes up with themes or sets targets that they intend to achieve, but never achieves them. And then the same goes for Agenda 2063. I think when they're coming up with these agendas, they come up with them thinking that they will never get to 2020 or 2063. And that is why they come up with them. And I say this because we rarely address the real issues that lead to conflicts. For instance, the Darfur war is partly as a result of water crisis, water shortage in the Darfur. So it started as a war between the black nomads and the Arabs, and they were fighting over water and the scarce resources for farming. And unless these issues are addressed, I doubt we can silence the guns. We also have to ask ourselves who is benefiting from the war, who is benefiting from the conflict. And there is an influx of firearm across the region, especially coming from Yemen through Somalia, distributed to the rest of Africa. So how do we ensure that this smuggling is stopped? And unless these issues are addressed, I doubt we can move forward. But speaking about climate action poses an opportunity for us to create jobs for many Africans. And climate change poses a greater threat to peace and security in Africa. And I'll give you a good example of water scarcity. So water scarcity has been a source of conflict across the region, not just in Darfur, but also, for instance, between Ethiopia and Kenya. So when the Omo River water levels go down, Ethiopians cross over to Kenya in search of green pastures for their livestock. And that brings conflict over the scarce resources that are on the Kenyan side. There's already conflict between Egypt and Ethiopia. Ethiopia is trying to build a dam from the Nile, yet 90% of drinking water in Egypt comes from the Nile. So if these issues are not addressed, we are staring at one of the biggest wars in the continent. And already Egypt has said if they don't solve this diplomatically, then they will address it through their armed forces. And Ethiopia has said that's not a big threat. We are ready for you. But I don't think that's the way to solve it. So when you look at climate conflict, even in our individual countries, for instance, in Kenya, anytime there is drought or famine, we see conflict between communities, nomadic communities that are migrating in search of green pastures for their animals. But then I prefer to look at climate action as a huge business opportunity. This was to be the decade of restoration. And for instance, if you're looking at restoration of forests that have been wiped out, I'm working on one project right now for restoration of a forest called Tanyai Forest. And the way we are looking at our project with the forest custodians, which is the Kenya Forest Service, is how can it benefit the communities that are living around this particular forest? Can we involve them from the initial stage of planting the seedlings, drilling the borehole, putting a fence around it, and involve them in the taking care of these young seedlings? When this finally becomes a forest, how can we turn it into a nature park where they can be benefiting from tourism? And these are some of the things that we need to think about when you're looking at climate action. Secondly, we have to involve communities. They need to realize they need to protect nature. They need to own the natural resources around them because this is their livelihood and their life depends on this. We rarely talk about climate refugees, but everybody, not just in Africa, but across the globe, is a crisis away from becoming a refugee. Imagine the rains that hit parts of Southern Africa last year in March. How many people were displaced? Where did they go? That's another source of conflict, because when you come to countries that are already struggling to feed their own citizens, having more people from foreign countries, that brings instability. Look at the case of Somalia and Kenya. We are hosting very many refugees from Somalia. We are hosting many refugees from South Sudan. So we need stability across the region. And unfortunately, disaster, when disaster strikes and like war, it's not something you can control. This is nature. So we really have to invest in climate action and look at it. Look at human-centered solutions, involve communities so that we can not only control climate change effects, but also stop conflicts. And we need to teach people that when you protect nature, when you protect nature and take care of nature, then you're actually averting major disasters, not just climate disasters, but also conflict-related crises. And I have had beautiful experiences working with rural communities. For instance, in 2018, we had a big campaign called Save Our Forest, KE, and there was a bit of conflict in the rural communities that live around forests, and were feeling that we were taking away their only source of livelihood. But then when we sat down and we had a dialogue with all the parties, these are for timber millers, this is the forest custodians and the rural communities, they got to appreciate that really what we are doing is not taking away what they rely on, but also looking for other ways, looking at other ways that they can benefit from these natural resources, as opposed to them cutting down trees and burning charcoal or timber from it. Imagine beekeeping. There's a huge demand for natural honey in the UK, for instance, and we cannot even meet the demand for honey in Kenya alone. So these are some of the things and some of the projects that we need to look at, because unemployment is also contributing to the conflict that we have. You find that young people are being recruited into terrorism because they don't have jobs, and this is the only alternative. When somebody tells you, I'll pay you $3,000 that goes to your family, and you'd never have raised that kind of money before, then this becomes attractive because you think, I will die, but my family will get $3,000. It might be little money to somebody else, but to them, that's a lot of money. And they're thinking, this could solve my family problems. But imagine if they had a regular income, a regular source of income that they could rely on. When there is shortage of water, for instance, and I feel that water is the next, will be the next source of cause of world war. I think it will trigger the third world war if we don't take care of it. You see, a country like South Africa, Cape Town ran out of water last year. South Africa doesn't have water. It gets its water from Lesotho. Imagine if Lesotho were to say that we are stopping this agreement between of supplying water to South Africa. Can you imagine such a scenario? So we need to really think about water and what are the infrastructures that we need to put in place as a continent to prevent future crises. When you think about water as well, coming from an agricultural village, when there is no water, we see increase in crime. Because if I don't have a source of income, I'm going to steal to feed my family. And agriculture, we say, is a food basket. We say countries like Kenya and areas that around forests are the food baskets of this country. But in the year 2018, we saw a shortage of water, and that was a threat to food security. And when there's a threat to food security, you will do anything to feed yourself and to feed your family. And I feel that we have a huge opportunity to both create employment and stop crisis and address the silencing of guns and achieve silencing of guns by 2020. I think that's not practical, but I feel that we can do this if you're willing. We have 10 years. This is a vital decade where everybody, both government, industry, and also development partners, can take part in it. So we need to come together around the table and have an honest conversation and look at how do we address the major issues that are affecting us. And most of these climate change issues are man-made. So how do we come together and put a grid aside and focus on people, the entire good as opposed to individual good?
Thank you so much for that and the wide perspective that you shared across Africa. And then although you did say it is a very ambitious agenda, it's a very ambitious strategy. The AU also has the Agenda 2063, the Africa we want. Mm-hmm. There's still time. What's the Africa you want?
To be honest, I'm at a very disappointed place. And I'm not sure anymore. I think the younger Wanjohi was very optimistic. This older Wanjohi is a bit skeptical. I think my bubble has been busted quite a number of times, and especially a time like now when we're dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, and I'm looking at how countries in this region are dealing with the crisis. And I have to applaud countries like South Africa, Ghana, and I think Uganda. The way they've handled the crisis is admirable. But when you come to my country, I doubt we have even leadership that cares about the people. Our priority right now is political. We are pursuing political needs at the expense of people's well-being. We are pursuing our selfish interests at the expense of our well-being. But that said, I think the Africa I would want to see is one where the citizens are empowered, because I feel that we do not invest in civic education enough, and that's our biggest problem. Because I need to understand what is the role of the leaders that I elect. What are the kind of leaders that I elect? Because I feel unless we elect leaders who have people's interests at heart, there's really nothing we are doing. Because these are the people who pass the laws that govern countries. And when you think about climate change, for instance, Paris Agreement was passed in 2015. African countries were among the first to ratify the agreement. But years later, there's no country. We have only one country, which is Kenya, which has passed a climate change act. This was passed in 2016, but it's not been implemented. Go to Africa Union itself. And Africa Union is an interesting organ because its Climate Change Act is still in its draft form since 2017. Yet this is the body that ought to be guiding the rest of the region on how to implement this policy. When you come to my country, yes, we have a 2016 Act, but the laws it operates under are even outdated. You know, the Environment Act is a 2006 Act, yet we passed a new constitution in 2010. So there is no commitment from our leaders. And unless we have real leaders who care about the people in office, I don't think Africa is going anywhere. I think it'll just go round in circles. So I think the broader question that we all must think about is how do we ensure that we have leaders who have people's interest at heart. And I think after that, we can talk about the Africa we want to see. Other than that, I think you're just having fun, enjoying ourselves and spending a lot of money in useless conferences. AU officials have flown business. They stay in the biggest hotels. I would really love to see the expenditure because I feel like 90% of their money goes to conferencing. And we must not talk about the Africa we want if you're not talking about the leadership. And that's a big issue. I would want to see Africa Union becoming the oversight body for the entire continent, the body that keeps countries in check. There ought not to be, you see, we have countries like Tanzania, which are taking COVID-19 lightly, leading to the spread of this disease across the region. We have countries like Uganda that have managed to flatten their curve, but they have to deal with truck drivers coming from Tanzania, country where the president has said there is no COVID. COVID is a fallacy, and so he's not taking any action. So why isn't Africa Union taking any action against such a leader who is putting the lives of very many other innocent people at risk and watering down the efforts of other countries? So I think these are some of the issues in my heart, and then I really doubt that we will achieve the Africa we want. I'm a bit of a skeptical. I'm a skeptic nowadays than I was before. I think I'm exposed to a lot of internal issues that make me realize that this continent is actually for a few people. The rest of us are just bystanders who help those few people achieve what they want.
Those are rather heartbreaking views. Unfortunately, they're also very valid. So yeah, the Africa we want is an Africa with leaders who have our interests at heart as Africans.
From the small, beautiful island of Seychelles, I spoke to global shaper and environmentalist Jeremy on his thoughts on the Africa Day 2020 theme as an African and a Seychellois.
For me, this juncture in time where we're seeing, you know, ongoing conflicts despite the whole pandemic, and I think, you know, making parallels to the climate change situation that we have, which is sort of being addressed, but not really. I think there's a lot of parallels between these two, you know, not unrelated events. I think even the case of climate change, it clearly is an amplifier for insecurity, not just for states, but for people. But I think the parallels is that what underlying causes are not being addressed. You know, we talk about disarmament, we talk about reintegration, demobilization of, you know, people being in conflicts. We look around the continent and these have to some extent worked, but in many cases not been resolved. So I think the underlying circumstances of conflict, the consequences that, you know, continue to perpetuate conflict in Africa are not being resolved yet. So I think it's interesting that we have an ambitious goal for this year to silence the gun, and obviously it's opportune for African Day to really speak to this flagship project for the AU. But we, as with climate change, realize that a lot of the underlying circumstances have not been addressed. We still have guns coming into Africa. We still have a lot of issues around conflicts being, how can I put it, diplomatically, being something which states are involved with within the African context, being aware of this in some ways and not necessarily addressing each other's issues, not being the best brother's keeper in that case. So I have hope, as with climate change, that, you know, action can give us some kind of respite. But I think we have to address the underlying issues for these things to come place. Speaking to the Seychelles kind of context, I think we're lucky to be relatively compared to the rest of the countries, not just in the Indian Ocean, but across Africa, to be a place where we are very secure. We are no ongoing conflicts in that case. We're a tiny country, and we might experience a spillover from other countries such as Somalia in the past with the piracy issues. But apart from that, we're very unaffected by larger conflicts in the region. And I think about climate change. I mean, for me, it's really about, you know, a security threat. If we understand for Seychelles, climate change is an existential threat for our state and our people, because, you know, whether it's sea level rise, ocean acidification, ocean temperature rise, it means not just, you know, destroying of all our critical infrastructure, but it's also like displacement of people, creating climate refugees. And this is something very real for Africa, as we see with Lake Chad and other regions which are being affected by climate change. So we're seeing in the next decade, in the next several decades that precede, that Africa will be hard hit by the effects of climate change. And this will be an amplifier for famine, for instability, for conflict, for refugees. So we're at a very interesting point right now when we're talking about Africa, security, and climate change. And I think silencing the guns, it's ambitious, as we need to be, but I think it's how do we basically think about human security and how guns are no longer the provider of, you know, options for certain people. How do we basically put the tools in hand that address, you know, food and other security, other issues that determine someone's security? How do we basically ensure Africans can put away their guns and, you know, be resilient to the challenges that we face in the next couple of decades?
So what would, for you, ideally, what would a conducive environment for Africa's development look like?
I think, you know, I think there's been some interesting benchmarks being reached so far, despite the whole global pandemic right now. I think we've got to look at this decade that has passed and look to the future and look at what has been achieved so far. So another flagship project by the AU, the African Free Trade Agreement and area, you know, that coming in, being ratified, coming into place, building some momentum. So this intra-Africa trade, we've always known this has been an issue that has, you know, when compared to other continents that have over 50% of their trade is within their continent. So, you know, a conducive environment is giving people options that are not putting them in harm's way, that are recognizing them as part of an economy. So I think for me, silencing the guns is the first step, because you need to basically have security before you can have investment, before you can have, you know, some sort of continuity and security in your workplace or in your living. So I think, you know, seeing this step in terms of demobilization, reintegration of people, this is of soldiers, I should say, and people involved in conflict, this is a critical step to getting people from areas where we're in a destructive or, you know, harmful setting to a place where we could be productive and stuff. And we need to also think about not just those who have been in conflict and, you know, has carried the mental and physical wounds that they've incurred, but also those who have been displaced internally and outside of Africa, you know, the amount of refugees camps. So I think it's about addressing the people who have been hurt in these moments, in these conflicts, and who have still maybe not been able to find home, not been able to find workplace. It's about giving these people options that integrate them into a work in Africa. So demobilizing, you know, soldiers who have been involved in conflict, stopping the conflict, is something that hopefully allows intra-Africa trade to be more of an option, more of a solution to the continent and to specific countries that have not been benefiting from that for a while, who have seen their resources and capital escape the country, escape their countries and the continent.
When you spoke, you mostly spoke of the bigger role that AU would play. I'm big on trying to involve citizens and citizen engagement and community engagement. What role would you say should be played by Africans, should be played by other Seychellois to contribute towards the bigger picture?
So for me, speaking firstly on Seychelles, I think it's a very interesting moment in time where part of a truth and reconciliation and national unity process in which injustices from the past are being recognized, are being brought forward. So hopefully we can heal or at least find some kind of common understanding about what happened and how we can proceed into the future. So there's an interesting moment now where the past has been dictating a lot of, you know, people's trust in the government, people's relationships with each other, you know, individuals who are not just victims, but also perpetrators. And in our case in Seychelles, there's a lack of perpetrators coming forward and admitting fault or giving closure to victims. So it's an interesting moment. And I think this is the thing about when we talk about public, the public consists of people who were involved on one side or the other of conflict sometimes. And as your part to encourage a family member or for you as someone involved coming forward, this takes immense courage, speaking in the Seychelles context where we're only 98,000 people and it's very personal. And I think for me, this is one of the parts that, you know, if your country has that process, it's amazing. But even, you know, from speaking as a youth myself who knows only snippets of this, having this process happen is amazing. And I think it's needed for me to understand my identity. So I'm hoping, you know, I've had experience in South Africa, having this history brought forward from an older generation who lived it to a younger generation that may not appreciate it as much. This is a vital thing. So people capturing on the kind of levels of conflict that they've experienced and making the younger generation aware of this is key. And I think speaking to, you know, generally Africa, I think, you know, civil society has played an immense role in various African countries in disarming ex-military people. And I think a lot needs to be said about their role. And I think for me, it's a case of looking out for, you know, those who have committed amazing stories and replicating them. I think it's about raising awareness so the public is aware that these things actually can work and there's faith in these things and support is given and finances are given. So I think as Africans, we must look for what has worked in the past and try and promote them amongst ourselves so that our government, elected officials and possibly other partners are able to implement these again and again. And again, it's about history. The more we're aware of our history, the less we can repeat it or we can prevent these mistakes.
Drawing from the African Union Agenda 2063, which is the Africa we want. What is the Africa you want? What's the Africa that Jeremy wants?
For me, it's about pride and I think it's about optimism. You know, I think it's we're a continent that is very complex. We're a continent that is sees a lot of, you know, past issues and a lot of current issues and a lot of future issues. But I hope that we're a continent that I know from various countries, including my own, but let me speak to the Nigerian context, where I know the most qualified immigrants to the United States are Nigerians. A lot of the people going to Europe, whether it be refugees or people who want university, as a youth member, like as someone, we need to basically attract and keep our youth in these countries, in our continent. You know, fine, maybe I won't stay in Seychelles, but I'll move to Botswana, or I'll move to South Africa, but I'll remain in my continent because I feel connected and affiliated and proud of my heritage and the future that it holds. So the Africa I want is one that it's not going to happen tomorrow or the next day, but it will happen if there's enough youth, enough energy to believe in this dream. So I hope in not just Seychelles, but around the continent, that we are proud of our heritage and work towards that common goal. I think this is key.
Lastly, from Nigeria, climate justice activist, agricultural economist, and eco-feminist Oladosu Adenike shared her take on the theme.
This theme, it means a lot to me and to every African, because this is our heritage. This is where we belong to. No matter where you are, maybe you're an African in diaspora, this is your base, Africa. You still remain an African child. So silencing the gun, it is a very important and key thing that is broad. It's beyond the physical gun the people are seeing. It's now all about the environment, developmental issues that are affecting Africa. And I've written it in my blog, womenandcrisis.blogspot.com, where I mentioned key issues on silencing the gun, disarmament. And in my video also on social media, Twitter, I also further explain what it means. But silencing the gun is like decarbonizing the environment, because what is happening now is that climate change is now a gun. It's killing people. People are losing their livelihoods to it. People are losing a lot because of this crisis. People are becoming more vulnerable. The rate of poverty is increasing in African countries. We are having insecurity challenges induced by climate change. Looking at Lake Chad. Lake Chad is a developmental issue that is affecting the peace and security in Africa, which I've been fighting for it to be recharged. Because it's due to this insecurity around this Chad basin, it led to the kidnap of some schoolgirls in the northeastern part of Nigeria, Borno State. These girls, some have been brought back while others are still in captivity. Some have been molested sexually, forced marry. So this is what this issue of guns can do in Africa, and that is why we need to silence it. If we don't silence it, there's no way we can achieve climate justice. There's no way we can achieve gender equality. There's no way we can achieve zero hunger. There's no way we can achieve other key sustainable development goals. So it's very important that we understand the broad aspect of this that is beyond the silencing the gun. It's getting into environmental decarbonization. How do we bring down the 1.5 degrees Celsius? That it won't affect our livelihood. It won't affect our environment. It won't affect our health and other well-beings of human beings. So today, African Day is a very key message out there. How do we protect our environment? How do we strengthen commitment towards achieving this goal that is the theme of the year, silencing the gun? We didn't just go beyond the theme or to transform it to the action, because we have a lot of projects to do in Africa. We have the Great Green Wall to restore, preserve, and sustain livelihood of many, including our biodiversity, that are very key to our coexistence. So all of these things, we need to put them into place. There are developmental issues that need to be taken care of. And everybody have a role to play, like I do say. In as much as leaders have their own role, we also have our own role to complement each other in all of these things. And anybody role that is find fault, it affects the others. And that's why we young people, we are raising our voices to see that something is done. We are saying these issues and we are saying it. Everybody is a leader in his own capacity, but we have some, we need to do more for our continent because Africa is the most vulnerable to climate change crisis and other pandemics. So we need to take care of it. We need to preserve our heritage. We need to safeguard our future through the actions that we are taking today.
I agree with you on us having to contribute, which is why we'd need a conducive environment for us to make our contributions. To you, what does a conducive environment for Africa's development look like?
When we say conducive, an environment that can support development, that can support innovations, whereby everybody's action counts. It's corrupt. There's no corruption. It's corrupt-free. Because corruption can also hinder development when there are things to be done and the money is siphoned, used for other non-essential purposes or not used for the fund needed for. So it's another issue that we need to deal with. A conducive environment is free from injustice that we are asking for. A conducive environment is an environment that we can see how we can work together, partner together, and do something great, where innovations and ideas transform into actions. You know, where we can be listened to, where we can do things together to see that we are out of this crisis and build upon our knowledge and what we want. You know, a conducive environment have climate governance, a governance that is ready to stand for the people and the environment. Now, recently, I've been campaigning for the green democracy, a democracy that is not only for the people, but also including the environment, because the environment is a key part of humanity. The environment is part of our living. It's part of humanity. It is inseparable. So there's a relationship, a strong relationship. Democracy now is not all about the people alone or human rights. It now has to include the environment, a government of the people and the environment, by the people and the environment, and for the people and the environment. You know, this is the kind of conducive environment that we are talking about. Environment that can withstand pandemic, that is built on a green foundation, as we have been demanding for a green recovery post-COVID-19. We don't want to make such a mistake we made during the 2008 financial crisis, that the green basis was disrupted because of the existing technology. Now we want it to be part of this recovery process, so that everybody can have a strong economy, an economy that can withstand pandemic. Because this pandemic has shown and have exposed a lot of weaknesses in our economy, that this economy that we are operating on is not conducive for the future. And now we are raising our voices, trying to see how world leaders, as they open their economy, they can put this in their mindset to boost the economy. So it's a kind of conducive environment that we are looking at, where everybody's opinion counts, actions are translated, ideas are translated into actions, and other key issues are taken into cognizance. All of these things we need to, and that is what it's look like.
Definitely. Looking at the African Union's Agenda 2063, which is the Africa we want, what is the Africa you want?
The Africa we want, something that everybody is raising their voices for today, where Africa, we have a peace and security. It will not be faced with uncertainties, insecurity. Because insecurity, in another angle, is also affecting development. Look at the farmer-herderman clashes, affecting food security, leading to hunger, poverty for those that depend on food production. But the Africa we want is an Africa that's innovative, that is ready to build a system that can accept innovations, that we can do things together to move towards the points that we want to achieve. The Africa we want is encompassing. It brings people together to solve issues, because we have our own demand, one way or the other, that we have been demanding and bringing forth developmental issues that are affecting our growth. In Africa, we want these people that can listen to our actions and translate it. It should be translated into something that will transform Africa. What we are seeing today, we are seeing injustices happening in Africa concerning our environment. We need listening ears as well, where we can do extraordinary things without degrading our environment, without harming the future generation. It has a lot. We have a lot to do for 2063 to see that this goal that we are trying to aim at, it comes into reality. We have a lot of things that is happening. The shrinking Lake Chad that is affecting development. The Great Green Wall Initiative, which came into being in 2007, is still another key issue for our ecosystem. If we can actualize or realize all of these things, initiative, it's going to help the Africa we want, where we now have the Great Green Wall that can support our biodiversity, support livelihoods, sustain people's growth, you know, where we can also recharge the Lake Chad for effectiveness to prevent further insecurity issues that can lead to war or clashes between countries, where countries will be going against each other. You know, when we have those things being done, key projects being achieved, then that is the Africa we want. An Africa that we can come together and see that, yes, this thing we can do together. Innovations I bring can be accepted in any African countries, where we can work together as one, regardless of the country where we are from.
Definitely. An Africa where we can work together. This week on African Bites, I had a chat with African Youth Envoy at the African Union, Aya Chebi. To you, what would you say climate change is, the way that you understand it?
And I see climate change as an issue that is intersectional with everything else. I cannot think of climate change as a separate thing. For me, it affects gender, it affects governance, it affects peace and security. So we cannot speak about all the other issues, ending poverty and all of that, if we don't deal with climate change. So for me, it's an emergency, it's a crisis, not climate change, it's climate crisis. But it's intersectional with every single thing in our aspect in our life.
Okay. And then how has it affected you directly, let's say in your day-to-day life, if it has affected you?
I mean, just look at the weather. I mean, in Tunisia now it's warm and it's not supposed to be. The farmers are complaining. Even our, you know, our daily life, our cities, the way they are built and constructed, we see the impact of the pollution, we see the impact of plastic, we see it's everywhere. I mean, even moms sometimes say things and I'm like, that's climate change. Mm-hmm. It's technical, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. So I think when we might not call it, you know, because of climate change or impact of climate change, but even my mom, my grandma, my young cousin, everyone can say things, this is unusual, this had never happened before, because things are changing, because we're not dealing with them in the urgency that we need to.
What do you wish people knew about climate change? So not just political, like across board, what do you wish people knew about it?
Exactly what we were saying. I wish people see it from their daily life, because I think when people look at climate change movements or political campaigning, they think it's an agenda out there that activists are advocating for. They don't see it as theirs, it affects their life. And you know, some of the other issues might not affect you. If we talk about, I don't know, like a very specific issue about women, men might not relate. If we talk about children's rights, you know, elders might not relate. But climate is like, in every single aspect of your life, it's connected to you. So I really want people to pay attention in their daily life. How does climate change affect them? In the water, the environment, in the weather, in the impact of pollution. When you go to urban, then rural, see the difference. So start observing. And when you realize it's hitting you, then start acting on it.
Speaking of action, that's my last question. What's the one action that you wish everyone around the world would take? If you had the power to say, everyone do this in relation to climate change, what do you think everyone should be doing?
Put climate change in every single policy, community, school, university, platform that you have. So whether you're working, you're in school, whether you are in the system in governance, wherever you are, whatever you play a role, put climate change on the table. So let us all try our best and contribute from our small spaces of influence to make a bigger impact.
Thank you for taking time to listen to this Africa Day episode of Sustain 267. I'll be posting new episodes every week exploring climate change and sustainability in Botswana and the rest of Africa, really. I was your host, Patoki Lisitse, and the sound engineer was Maleho Makgoti. Like our Facebook page, Sustain 267, share your thoughts on what Africa Day and its theme mean to you and any recommendations for topics you'd like to know more on. Let's stay safe and follow government recommendations so we do our bit to beat COVID-19. Happy Africa Day!
Sustain 267.